Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to have John Roth on the show again. John is Edward J. Sexton Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Claremont McKenna College, and he and I first met a little over a decade ago at the Holocaust Education Foundation's Holocaust Boot Camp, at least that's what we called it, at Northwestern University. He was an instructor there, and it was a wonderful 2 weeks. It's an experience I heartily recommend for those of you in the audience who are grad students or faculty members. And John and I have kept in touch since then. He's generously agreed to be on the show twice before, once with Carol Rittner to talk about their edited compilation on rape as a weapon of war, and once to talk about the Oxford Handbook of Holocaust Studies with Peter Hayes. And I should say, Peter and I have an interview time scheduled out here for the next couple weeks, and so he'll be on the show here in maybe a month or so. This time, we're talking about the new volume John edited with Leonard Grobe. The title of that is Losing Trust in the World, Holocaust Scholars Confront Torture. And the book assembles a dozen or so of the preeminent thinkers and researchers to see what can be said about torture in the light of the Holocaust. The contributors come from several countries. They include philosophers, historians, and academics who specialize in religious studies. And I found the result fascinating, in some ways because of the common perspectives they share, in other places because of the disagreements that emerge out of this discussion. And so we're going to talk about that today, and I'm looking forward to it. And so with that, John, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us again on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Kelly, thanks for having me on the show again. I'm looking forward to your interactions, and we'll hope that we can make something good happen here.
So traditionally, John, I asked at the start guests to say something about themselves, and you've already done that. But maybe we can just give you a chance. It's been a while. Maybe you can say a little bit of something about how you came to be a philosopher and how you came to be interested in the Holocaust.
Sure. We're talking to each other in April of 2017, and it was just 50 years ago this spring that I was finishing up my very first year of teaching at what was then Claremont Men's College. Became Claremont McKenna College when it went coeducational. I spent most of my scholarly teaching career at that place, which proved to be a very good place for me to do my work. I became really interested in the Holocaust about 6 years after I started teaching in Claremont. But prior to that, an influence on me had been my reading of a book called After Auschwitz, which was published in 1966. Its author was Richard Rubinstein, who is still alive and working as a scholar as we speak. His book was one of the early ones to address the religious implications of the Holocaust, in particular what the Holocaust in Rubinstein's view did to traditional thinking about the God of history. That book influenced me, but it didn't spark the kind of turn that my career and personal life took a few years later, when at the suggestion of a former teacher of mine, Frederick Sontag, I started reading the works of Elie Wiesel. Mm. This was in the early summer of 1972, just a few weeks actually before my second child was born. And the reading of those writings by Wiesel created what I refer to as a kind of collision in my life. My life at that time, I was in my early 30s. My academic career was underway and flourishing. Family life was good. Everything was moving in kind of an American dream kind of direction for me. And I found myself, through the suggestion of my former teacher, plunged into the world of the destruction of family, the destruction of senses of the future, destruction of hope, kind of the antithesis of what I was experiencing in my own personal life. And the collision that resulted from that resulted in a kind of professional and existential turn in my life. And I became, as I now sometimes call myself, a philosopher who got tripped up by history, and in particular tripped up by Holocaust history. And reoriented my life and my research and my teaching and everything else that's followed since. So it's been a long time that I've been involved in the study of the Holocaust and genocide and human rights issues. And as our discussion today suggests, that took me, among other things, into an interest in torture.
So I hadn't anticipated asking this, but it seems an appropriate question for the book. So you talk about having young children, and you and I know from chatting just a moment ago that I have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old, and they're just now old enough to start looking at the books on my bedside table. So how did you talk to your children about your interest, and how did you frame that discussion?
Well, it still is an ongoing part of my life. I live very close by to where my daughter lives, who I referenced a moment ago. She's now the mother of a 14-year-old girl who's a granddaughter. I had the experience last year in her seventh grade year to work with a teacher in the local middle school here who was doing a substantial unit on the Diary of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself in a classroom again, but this time with a group of seventh graders, 13-year-olds at the time, where my role was not so much to discuss the diary, but to try to provide some context about World War II, about Nazism, about anti-Semitism, and the related things that had to do with the saga of Anne Frank and her diary. So what I've found is that in talking with my own family about the work that I do, is that there's always a kind of puzzlement on their part about how their husband, how their father, how their grandfather, you know, spend so much time kind of working on these really, really dark topics. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, they're intrigued and interested in it. And I've had the chance, I think, to extend my teaching in part to my own family as well as to students who have ventured into my classroom. But it is an odd thing. Here's a semi-humorous thing. My wife still teases me about how I owe her because we spent our 25th wedding anniversary on the actual day of our 25th anniversary. We were in Auschwitz, and this was because of some work that I was doing, and my wife was along. She went with me on that trip, and so she gets it, but at the same time, she keeps reminding me that I owe her.
Well, you know, my 25th anniversary is coming up here in a year and a half, so I now consider myself having been given permission to take my wife to Auschwitz for our anniversary.
Yeah, well, you better ask her about that, too.
You said you were a philosopher tripped up by history. I'm wondering what that background and interest in philosophy, how that shapes your approach to a historical event like the Holocaust.
Yeah. Well, I remain, in my own mind, a philosopher. Mm-hmm. Albeit one who engages deeply with historical topics and research. And here's what I would emphasize about the importance of philosophy to me. I think that philosophy is, among other things, the keeper of the key questions. Mm. The questions about how do we know things? What's right? What isn't? How do we wrestle with the difference between right and wrong? Philosophy always has questions that can't be answered by history, let's say, mm-hmm. by historical scholarship. And that's been one of the things that has led me to emphasize the importance of philosophy when we are studying things like the Holocaust and other genocides and mass atrocities. Because we often find ourselves, I think, confronting the fact, and I think it's a fact, that what we're studying is so deeply and fundamentally wrong. We study events over and over again, if we're Holocaust and genocide scholars, that should not or ought not to have happened. And yet they did happen. And they affect, you know, the world that we live in and the future that we face. So the questions that philosophy brings to the table here are questions about, well, why do these things happen? Mm-hmm. Even how did they happen? What do we have to think about to even begin to approach understanding of these events? Now, that's something that the study of history can do and is essential for doing, but history raises questions that can't be answered by more visits to archives or mm-hmm. to historical accounts. The questions that are raised may not be answerable by any human inquiry, but they certainly invite inquiry of that kind. So, for example, one of the things that I've worked on very recently has to do with what I call the failures of ethics. And I'm struck by the fact that it seems to me that the atrocities that we study when we explore the Holocaust and genocide and torture nearly always involve the overriding or the subversion or the undermining of ethical imperatives or mm-hmm. ethical intuitions that we have. One of the things about torture that I think the scholars in our book came, you know, we didn't come to this conclusion. We had it, but it was reinforced, and that is that torture is not good. Some people may argue that it's necessary, mm-hmm. but it that doesn't even make it a good thing. Mm-hmm. And yet torture is taking place even as we speak in the world today. So some of the questions that have haunted me, especially as a philosopher, have to do with why is it that our ethical impulses and our ethical institutions and our traditions and teachings about ethics seem to be so fragile mm-hmm. and so easily overridden and so easily subverted and turned to nefarious ends. So these are issues, I think, that call out for philosophers to engage with. But in order to do that, philosophy has to be willing to run the risks of really immersing itself in history. Mm-hmm. And my quarrel with my own discipline of philosophy is that too often it shies away from the historical. And so I'm glad that I became tripped up by history in the way that I have done as a philosopher, because I think getting tripped up by history makes philosophy stronger and better at the same time that that history leads eventually to questions that go beyond history and that become the questions that philosophers are most interested in.
You've written a large number of books, and you've been working in this study group or seminar. I'm not sure how you'd characterize it, but on the Holocaust for quite a while. Why is it important to you that and your co-authors, right, the people you're working with, why do you think we should be particularly thinking about torture now?
Yeah, it's a good question, and let me approach it by explaining a little bit how the book called Losing Trust in the World came about, because that's integral to your to your query here. Since the middle part of the 1990s, I've been part of a seminar that gathers every other year at a place called Roxton College, which is located in a beautiful English village about 50 miles north of Oxford in the United Kingdom. This seminar was conceived and originated by Leonard Grobe, who's my co-editor in the book on torture, and his friend and colleague, Hank Knight, who is the executive director of the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College in New Hampshire. Hank and Lenny got the idea that it would be interesting to gather together a group of about 35 scholars who were interested in the Holocaust and genocide to meet and talk about you know, whatever topics were on their mind in a kind of small group, quiet kind of setting that would involve being together for the greater part of a week and having enough time to talk and engage with one another. When the group first convened in 1996, I think it was, one interesting thing that happened was that small groups began to form, and these groups became kind of through a natural process of evolution and growth, what I would call writing circles. The people in the group decided that, yeah, it was great to be together there in Roxton, but we needed to do something that went beyond that. And so one of the things that some of us committed to do was to write on different topics and share our writings with each other. Out of that commitment emerged eventually a book series that has been primarily published by the University of Washington Press in Seattle. I've been one of the co-editors of that series. The other person is David Patterson, who was also a member of the original Roxton group. David is a very fine scholar teacher, now working at the University of Texas at Dallas. So over a period of almost 20 years now, this book series has some 10 titles in it, including a couple of volumes that were published elsewhere, not by the University of Washington Press. Several of the books in the series have the quality that can be found in the book called Losing Trust in the World. That is, the group of people involved in some of these books decides to take up a topic that isn't necessarily about the Holocaust, but that has some connection to study of the Holocaust. And we write about the topic, share our writings with each other, and the goal is to try to emerge from this with a book that has a what we call a dialogical quality, because in the writing process we actually respond to each other in writing. So we've done a number of these. We did a volume, for example, that focused on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Another volume in the series is a kind of trilogue that involves Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scholars. Some of the work on that book was done at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. We're currently working on one that focuses on refugees. And we recently published the volume that we're talking about today that is about torture. Now, what's the connection between the Holocaust and these topics? Well, the idea with the torture volume was that, first of all, there was a group of people in the Holocaust seminar at Roxon who had an interest in torture. Mm-hmm. And we discovered this by talking to one another. And then we thought, well, we are also scholars of the Holocaust and genocide. So what might we have to say from the perspective of our scholarly expertise about torture? How would our expertise on Holocaust studies and genocide studies lend itself to reflecting in a way that might be of some utility on a topic like torture? So we decided to try writing on this and to share with each other, as we had done before, what we came up with. And the result eventually was the book that we called Losing Trust in the World. So that's a little bit about the genesis of the volume. Mm-hmm. What we're not saying that our interest in the Holocaust or other genocides makes us experts in these other topics. What we're exploring is whether our expertise on the Holocaust and genocide studies lends itself to perhaps having some insights about topics that are maybe more contemporary and more current, such as torture. And it's a little bit of an experiment to see, you know, what emerges or where the inquiry goes. But we found, as we've done projects of this kind together, that the outcome is of interest. Mm-hmm. And we hope that's true in the volume that we've done on torture. Mm-hmm. Now, I might add just one more point here before we go in perhaps a different direction. The title of this book, A Losing Trust in the World, is taken from the writings of a Holocaust survivor whose literary name is Jean Amaury. Jean Amaury and his book, At the Mind's Limits, contains what I regard as one of the classic texts on torture in the whole body of writing that exists on torture. Amaury was an Austrian Jew from a highly assimilated family. He was trained and practiced philosophy as kind of an academic specialization. In the mid-1930s, at about the time the Nuremberg laws were passed in Germany, Amaury sensed that Austria was probably pretty high on history on Hitler's list for takeover. And Amaury, in retrospect, began to refer to himself as a dead man on leave in light of the Nuremberg laws. He eventually fled to Belgium, where he was engaged in resistance against the Nazi regime after Belgium was occupied by the Germans. And he was arrested by the Gestapo, tortured. And when the Gestapo discovered that he didn't have anything of value to them, but they had learned that he was a Jew, he was deported to Auschwitz. He survived Auschwitz and went on to have an important career as a writer and commentator, including doing some radio shows that were broadcast in Germany. And one of the most important chapters in his writing is this essay that he simply calls Torture. That essay became, for the writers in the book that we're talking about today, that became kind of the anchor all of the essays in one way or another reference or reflect upon or think about Jean Amaury and his essay on torture. Amaury said that when he was tortured, and he suspects that this is true of anyone who is tortured, that one of the results of torture is a loss of trust in the world, by which he meant loss of confidence that help will be available to you, loss of confidence in traditions of an ethical or political kind that would seem to stand for human rights and for the integrity and the dignity of the human person, things of that kind. So we took the title for this volume from Amaury, and the book is called Losing Trust in the World, Holocaust Scholars Confront Torture.
I've been thinking a lot about this idea of a canon of Holocaust literature. And you mentioned the Diary of Anne Frank, and I will be taking my students here in about a month to Amsterdam to the Anne Frank House. And, of course, Wiesel that you mentioned, and my daughter has similarly read Wiesel in middle school. Why is Amaury, or is Amaury part of that canon? He seems to me somebody that Holocaust scholars know instinctively, but many people who don't spend their lives thinking about this do not.
Yes, I think he's definitely part of the canon for people who are interested in reflective writings about the Holocaust. Even writings that are reflective in an explicitly ethical sense. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't enjoy the readership of Wiesel or Levy, Primo Levi, or Anne Frank, people of that kind. And one of the reasons why I think that's the case, I've come to the conclusion that I'm going to give you in a second here as a result of my own teaching. Amaury is a very dark writer. There's very little of a hopeful, let alone a redemptive motif in his reflections. You can see this in his commentary on torture, that the result of torture in Amaury's experience was a loss of trust in the world. Mm-hmm. It devastated him. He later went on to write about aging. He wrote about suicide. Huh. He's one of these tragic Holocaust survivors who eventually took his own life. Mm-hmm. So his writings reflect that kind of darkness. And ethically speaking, this is kind of interesting. Amaury was never interested in reconciliation. He was never certainly not interested in anything involving forgiveness of anybody. His ethical category was resentment. He remained resentful of the Holocaust and of the torture that it inflicted. And there's this kind of deep-seated seething anger in his writing. It's muted, but you feel it when you read him. And his word for this was resentment. He deeply resented what had happened. He says this in an understated way at one point. He says, what happened, happened, but that it happened cannot be so easily accepted. And this anger, resentment, I have found immensely appealing in many ways as an ethical thinker. That is, he did not want people ever to allow their memory of the Holocaust to be without resentment that it happened. I think it's profound. And yet there is something very dark about this resentment, because Amaury went on to say that he knew that this resentment was futile. He often liked to talk about how the past will recede. People, the past does not have the privileged temporal component that the future has, and that people are going to think about the future. And therefore, the resentment that he felt so strongly, and that he wanted to be part of the post-Holocaust ethic, I think that he stood for, he felt this too was a kind of losing cause. And I've been kind of haunted by that as I've thought about his writings and his essay on torture in particular. Amaury would be one who would say, he says at one point, somewhere, even at this very moment, someone is being tortured.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He never, I think he never had any illusions that torture would ever go away, but he resented it. And so that motif kind of became the anchor in Holocaust studies that mm-hmm. that influenced and governed in effect the writing that people went on to do in the book.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. In my mind, I often think about it in conjunction with Primo Levi's later book, The Drowned and the Saved, which is, as you say, reflective and I don't know, dark or depressing, or I don't know what the right word is, but. But your book, so your book is organized around three big questions, and I'm going to do the impossible, or ask you to do the impossible. It's the position I get to be in as the host. Maybe let's think about them each for 5 or 6 minutes or so, recognizing
sure.
that in fact all of the listeners should run out and get the book and read it for themselves. But the first section, I mean, we've been talking about this a lot. The first section asks a really simple question. What is torture? So is there a simple answer?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. The question, what is torture, looks like it is asking for a definition and is asking for words that somehow identify what torture is. And that's very important. And I'll try to illustrate that in just a second. But it's also fair to say that whatever else torture is, it's something that words alone can't pinpoint and can't describe. Because of this, goes back to Amaury and his experience of torture was that, you know, as he said, it destroys trust in the world. So it there's an experiential dimension to this that is devastating and destructive and goes so deep down that probably it eludes words. So, but to keep it a little bit on the word side of things, I had an interesting email just a few days ago from my good friend Michael Barenbaum, who will be known to many of your listeners, one of the great Holocaust scholars and people who have done amazing work in developing memorials and museums that focus on the Holocaust and other genocides. So Michael wrote a brief message to me and said, I need a favor. He said, I'm working on some kind of a museum project. He didn't identify it in detail. But he said, here's what he told me. He said, I need a 40 445 character caption on torture. Now, what he meant was, it's not 445 words, he said, it's the characters. It's like each letter and space would be a character. So it's very short. It's a caption.
Yeah.
So I expect it's for a photograph or for something. So he said he needs this on torture. So he said, could you please do this for me? You worked on this book on torture. And I said, okay, sure, I'll give it a try. Now, I found this harder to do than it looked like it might be at first glance. But let me just share my it's less than 445 characters, actually. But this is what I said, and I think this statement, very brief, kind of gets at several dimensions of the question, what is torture? So here's what I wrote for Michael Barenbaum. I said, torture is an atrocity that inflicts severe pain and suffering, physical or mental, to coerce, punish, or terrorize. Nobody wants to be tortured, a fact that complicates, if it does not falsify, all attempts to justify torture. But right now, somewhere, torturers, usually government-directed, are at work. What they do is worse than words can say. Moral protest and political resistance against torture are much-needed actions. So that was my 445 character attempt to state what I think torture is. And it involves the attempt to define it using words to do that, but it also alludes to the fact that whatever torture is, it's something worse than words can ever say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the dilemma that makes torture such a fraught reality in our world. Now, the importance of defining torture is that torture is understood to be, in international law, and also in American law, for those of us who are Americans, it's understood to be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for torture to be criminalized, you have to have words that define it. So the classic definition of torture is located in the United Nations Convention Against Torture, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to 1987. And here I'll just read a few of the words from that that definition. The Convention Against Torture, the United Nations Convention Against Torture, defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession. Mm-hmm. Now, that convention goes on to say that torture is not confined entirely to the intention to try to obtain information or a confession. It can be also used to punish, to do almost anything that an official, or now we have to think about non-state actors, want to do that would have the effect of intimidating, coercing, terrorizing people. Mm. So it's broadly understood, even though it's the case that a classical way to understand torture is that it is used to elicit information or to extract a confession that someone in a position to be presumably able to do either of those things, that is, confess to something that they've done that's wrong or provide information that might help to prevent a crime, it's the case that the understanding of torture is often focused on those kinds of circumstances. But it's actually broader in the way the UN Convention goes on to talk about it. So this is why torture is an ongoing and even a contemporary topic in the world today, and in particular, again, for your listeners who are Americans, in an American context. Because it has to do with the belief that is quite widespread that somehow torture, as President Trump would say, works, absolutely works, as he said repeatedly during the campaign and again at the end of January of 2017.
Well, so, and so that gets us to that next question, is that the book addresses, and that is torture justifiable, which is a huge big question that you can't talk about in 5 minutes. But I guess maybe I'd start by saying how do philosophers try and think about that question?
Yeah, well, I think I'll try to answer the philosophical part of it first. For sure, one thing that philosophers would ask is. Is torture justifiable in an ethical sense? It would be a question that would lead right away to ethical inquiry. Can torture be justified in a way that meets ethical tests? In addition, anyone who thinks about torture critically here is going to have to address the question of its utility. Mm-hmm. You know, does it work? Mm-hmm. And to do that requires you to, you know, get into actual historical, political circumstances to see empirically and to think empirically about the utility of torture. In the book, I would say the authors are fairly, I put it this way, I think all of the authors, there are 11 of us in the book, would say that ethically speaking, torture is wrong. Torture is not a good. It is not something that is ever capable of being elevated to saying that torture is a good thing to do. There's a difference of opinion in the writers about whether torture nevertheless may be necessary or may be useful. We have the category of a necessary evil. Or the category of saying that, well, something is wrong ethically, but we might still have to do it. The fact that something is ethically wrong may not be a sufficient reason to not to do it. So there's that dilemma. And there are some differences of opinion about that that reflect the kinds of circumstances that we've seen that lead someone like Donald Trump to be a kind of defender of torture, even though, you know, he is presently deferring to his defense secretary Mattis and other people in the military who want to say, no, I can probably do better with a pack of cigarettes and a few cans of beer in interrogating someone than I can do if I torture them to get information. So, but there is this kind of, you know, I would call it a temptation, a kind of belief to think, and it has a long history behind it, because history has a torture. It isn't something that just came on the scene recently by any means. But the long history of it was that somehow you could get a reluctant person to give up the goods, to tell you the truth, to confess to a crime, if that's what was on the table, if you inflicted massive distress and pain and suffering upon them. Now, this is an argument that has to be waged both on the ethical side and on the empirical side. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of evidence empirically that comes sometimes from scholarly research and sometimes from on-the-ground military practice that at the very least calls into question the efficacy of torture. That, you know, General Mattis may have it right. A pack of cigarettes and some alcohol and conversation may get you much farther than, inflicting torture. Or, as the euphemistic language, which always has to be watched, I think, very closely, enhanced interrogation techniques can accomplish. One of the insidious things about torture is that it leads to the most amazing rhetorical efforts to justify the infliction of pain and suffering without calling it torture. Mm-hmm. American history since 9/11 is full of this kind of thing. And these are documents that you can get an access online, where everyone is who's wanting to defend these enhanced interrogation techniques, of which waterboarding is sort of the poster child example, go to great lengths to explain not only the efficacy of such techniques, but to deny that they are torture. When in fact, in international law, and now in American law too, it's understood that they are torture. So it's a vexed and fraught issue.
Yeah.
But the evidence that is of a scholarly kind, this is interesting, includes research that has been done fairly recently by people in the field of neuroscience that want to demonstrate the difficulty here is you can't really run the experiments, but it's based on, you know, the best judgments that you can get. But there is evidence in the neuroscience field here that torture does things to the human brain that are not conducive to accurate memory, for one thing, or to truth telling on the other. So, torture is happening as we speak. There are people who are prepared to argue for its efficacy, particularly if you can get by without naming the acts that you want to use as torture, on the one hand, and on the other, empirical evidence that calls into question the efficacy of torture, and then you've got the whole ethical dilemma that is important because it goes to the understanding of what kind of a culture does one want to be part of? What kind of a society does one want to identify with? Mm-hmm. Do we want to be a society and a culture that tortures? Or not?
Yeah.
Well, and
now,
that's,
this goes,
yeah, go ahead.
If I can take it just one step back to the book, this goes back to Amory, who thought that torture was of the essence of Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have studied Amory have wondered about that. They've wondered, you know, what was he getting at? Why did he think that? And was he correct in the assessment? I think what Amory was getting at was that Nazism was predicated, especially with regard to Jewish life, not only with its destruction, not only with the destruction of Jewish lives, but with the destruction of Jewish tradition, which meant that that the people who were destined for death needed to be degraded before they died, and their traditions needed to be degraded. We think about, you know, why were the Nazis hell-bent on the destruction of things like Torah scrolls and things of that kind? This is kind of part of that dimension of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that Amory believed that Nazism entailed the development of a human personality that was not only capable of torture, but willing and eager to do it as needed. I think that's part of what he had in mind when he thought that torture was an essential part of what he took Nazism to be. I mentioned he's a pretty dark thinker, and this would be another aspect of that darkness, I think.
I think it's hard to be a, I don't know what the opposite of dark, light or happy thinker is given this subject, but I can see that. And I just want to nod to an essay that we don't have time to talk about, but I think is appropriate here. And that's, and I hope I'm getting her name right, Dorota Glowacka, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Glowacka,
Polish, I believe, who talks about the place where language falls apart and the implications of that falling apart. But that maybe leads us to that third question. And again, in the interest of time, and again, there's a very interesting essay about attempts by therapists and others to get over, to help victims address the long-term consequences of torture. Maybe I'll just ask you to stick to your essay then. With this question about what can be done about torture, and you look at rape torture in R2P. So maybe can you talk about what you wanted to do with that essay and why talk about rape in this context?
Yeah. Let me back up just for a second in a more general way about what can be done. I think one of the most meaningful essays in the book is the one that focuses on the attempts to do therapy with torture victims. This is an essay written by Margaret Brearley, who has actually done some work with torture victims. And so the what can be done about torture question ranges all the way from developing therapies that can help torture victims to cope, to try to gain back some sense of trust in the world that torture has robbed them of, to the political side of the spectrum that tries to beef up resistance against the practice of torture, all the way to the idealistic hope that I think everyone would agree with if they thought about it, and that would be that a world without torture would probably be a better world than the one that we have. So I became interested in thinking about my essay on torture in two dimensions of the problem. One is the way in which torture, I think it's often and maybe long been this way, but certainly in its more recent manifestations, torture has become sexualized. Mm-hmm. That is, it has involved the use of rape and other forms of sexualized violence as a means of inflicting torture. Which is to say that rape and other forms of sexualized violence are used as means to inflict pain and suffering of both physical and mental kind, that may sometimes be used to try to extract information or confessions, but certainly have been used to coerce and to punish and to terrorize people. So much so now that rape, for example, is understood as an example, as a form of torture. It isn't, I've had discussions with people about this, it isn't that rape is reducible to torture. Rape has its own sexualized violence that goes beyond rape, has qualities that are not reducible to anything except, you know, horror and atrocity. But it's important to see that rape and sexualized violence are now understood to be part of torture and even parts of genocide. So international law and understanding has been evolving and expanding to include these forms of violence and to interpret them as involving and being under the rubric of torture in some cases. So I wanted to, as I said in my essay, I said no book on the topic of torture could possibly be or could possibly approach completeness without taking up the topic of gender issues and sexualized violence and rape in particular. So that's where I, you know, directed my attention. And then as I began to, you know, think about, okay, this is all really atrocity in a big way. What can be done about it? I'd also been working for a time on the fragile but evolving a norm that is sometimes referred to as the responsibility to protect, or in its short form as R2P. This idea, which has a foothold in international law now, has had that status for about a decade, operates on the idea that when a nation or a state is unwilling or incapable of protecting its citizens against, you know, mass atrocities or human rights abuses, then the international community has the responsibility to protect, to intervene, to try to prevent the worst from happening. So my essay on rape as torture turns to the idea of the responsibility to protect, you know, to see what traction that idea might have as a response to torture, as an idea that might be important if we are going to have an effective resistance against the atrocity of torture.
So I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to jump off from that, and it would be wonderful to have a while to think about Syria in this context, and I'm not sure we do now, but but I would encourage the audience, if you haven't had a chance to read Janine DiGiovanni's book about Syria, I think it's called The Morning They Came for Us. It's got a nice, I don't know if nice is the right word, but a journalistic account of torture in Syria in a kind of reflective effort to come to grips with what that means, which maybe is the jumping off place for one of the last couple of questions. And here I want to refer to Suzanne Brown Fleming's essay. We've had Suzanne on the show before. And she's got an essay about Johann Baptist Neuhäusler. I think I've got that right. And one of the really interesting things about this your book is structurally is that you in each chapter the author completes her or his essay, and then there are questions that the co-contributors ask about that. And one of the questions really pushes Brown Fleming, who has a family history of the Holocaust, of a grandfather who was a Nazi. And she's asked to reflect on what kind of responsibilities Neuhäusler, who was a Catholic priest who ended up in Dachau, had toward the torture that happens in Dachau. And by extension, what kind of responsibilities people in the present have. And Brown Fleming responds, I try to produce the, and this is a quote, I try to produce the fullest possible picture of the participants, victims, and surrounding circumstances of this piece of history as, above all, a memorial to the victims. Will this be useful? She asks. I don't know. Is it enough? No. And I could go on with the quote, but that's where I want to stop. This is a really profound set of essays. So let me ask you what the question Brown Fleming asks herself. Is this book enough?
Emphatically, no. No book, no words could be enough where something like torture is concerned. And Amaury is probably right that as long as human beings exist in political circumstances that involve conflict, the temptation, if not the practice, to torture torture will be in the cards. But I think reflection on torture pretty clearly will lead a person to the conclusion that, as I said earlier, torture is never a good thing. A world free of torture and the temptations that lead to it would be a better world than the one we have. So the impulse to try to do something about torture can exist and can become intense. Then the question becomes, okay, what can anybody do about it? Yeah. And I think the answer to that question is, well, all sorts of things can be done about it. One of the things that scholars can do is to, you know, write essays and produce a book that may have a effect in some small way how its readers think about these things and respond to them. But all of us have multiple ways to respond to a world that is savaged by torture. It can involve the way we spend our money, the causes that we choose to support. It can involve things like what Margaret Brearley did, that is trying to figure out if there's a way to get involved in helping the victims of torture. It can involve the ways we vote, the political leaders that we choose and back. There's no lack of things that that people can do if they're interested in standing against torture and its practice. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of figuring out which ones were best situated to do. One of the things that my long years of teaching about the Holocaust and genocide has led me to underscore is that it's always important to look to see where we have some leverage, and then to make use of the leverage that we have. And everybody has some, if only in the role of educating their own children or, you know, how they talk to their spouse or something like this. Other people have more leverage. And some of us have a lot of leverage. So it's a question of choosing. And I guess the last thing I would say is the longer I live, the more I find myself nourished by Albert Camus, the French philosopher and writer, and his famous myth of Sisyphus. He took the story of the Greek figure of Sisyphus, who was condemned to the fate of rolling a stone up the hill, only to have it fall back. And having to repeat that act to eternity because he had defied the fates and the gods and had even tried to defy death itself. And Camus writes about Sisyphus and says that when he thinks about Sisyphus having to go back down the hill and to deal with that rock again and push it back up the hill, he somehow imagines Sisyphus happy. And it's a tough happiness, if that's the word for it. Camus insisted it was. And so I think that's where we are with things like torture and other mass atrocities. We may never be able to succeed in eliminating them altogether, but it's worth trying, and we can take joy and find joy, perhaps, and definitely find meaning in resistance and protest against things like torture.
Well, I often end these interviews by asking guests, and I'm going to do this to you, to suggest a book or two, or maybe a movie or something else. And I'm going to guess Amory is one of those. What was meaningful to you while you were writing this book, or just in general in your thinking about the Holocaust and human rights?
Okay, I want to go to the film side first, if I can, because there are just anybody who wants to search, you know, documentaries or films that involve torture in one way or another. All you have to do is do Google searches, and you'll get a lot. One of the authors in our volume wrote about Slumdog Millionaire, a film that I think won an Academy Award that has a torture thread running through it. I am aware from some searching that I did preparing for your questions here that there's a series called 24. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen this. I may check it out myself, but it apparently has torture motifs throughout it. I've just finished watching the two seasons of the alternate history series called The Man in the High Castle, which operates on the premise that Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan won World War II, and there's plenty about torture going on in that film. Here's what I think is the problematic feature of some of the fictionalized films that involve tropes about torture. I think they reinforce, unfortunately, the notion that torture works. Or they reinforce another outlook that is undoubtedly mythical, and that is that people resist torture successfully.
Hmm.
That we see the examples over and over again of the utterly courageous person who never breaks, who never, you know, gives up anything or never talks. My hunch is that that's myth. And I say that partly because Amaury certainly thought it was. When he describes what happened to him in torture, when he was tortured, one of the things he says almost immediately is, "I talked."
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on to say that what he talked about was it wasn't information, it wasn't confession, because he had nothing to say that was of any use to anybody, but he talked about all sorts of things. And my guess is that there's more truth in Amaury's few words about that than there is in episode after episode of television filmmaking that involves torture, where the people being tortured are heroic and, you know, never crack and never do anything other than act in courageous and heroic ways. But anyway, the filmic cinematic dealing with torture, all the way from documentary to, you know, science fiction and historical fiction, is very full. Lots of things there. On the book side, I'd mention, you know, three titles that might be helpful to people listening who are at various stages in their interest in this topic. One is certainly Amaury's book, At the Mind's Limits, and in particular his essay, which is short, it's 20 pages or so, just simply called Torture. That's been anthologized in a number of places. There may even be just an online accessibility to it. And if anyone is interested in torture, I regard Amaury's reflection on it as definitely one of the classics in that area of writing. A very good kind of introduction to the history and the wide, multi-dimensional aspects of torture is a book called The Phenomenon of Torture, edited by William Schultz, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. It's a good starting point for someone who might be interested in, you know, learning about various dimensions of this topic. And then the third one I'd mention is a book, I think Harvard University Press is the publisher. The book maybe came out in 2015. It's called Why Torture Doesn't Work. Its author is an Irishman, I believe, named Shane O'Mara. And he is one of the people who's doing research on torture from a kind of cognitive science, neuroscience perspective. And mounting the argument that torture is not efficacious for reasons that are deep-seated in our growing understanding of how the human brain works. So people who are interested in a more kind of technical, even scientific, scholarly kind of approach to torture and questions about its efficacy might find that volume worth delving into.
Well, the end of the semester is approaching, and 3 days after graduation, I get on a plane with 14 undergraduates to go to Europe, which means I've got plenty of time to read, so maybe I'll take those along with me. But I'm not sure what kind of reputation that will get me on the plane if I'm carrying those. But this has been fascinating, John. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I hope whenever you're done with the next project, you'll come back and talk with us on the show again.
Well, thanks again, Kelly, for having me and for doing the podcast on this dark but important reality, torture.
Very All right, important. Take care, John. You've been listening to an interview with John Roth about his new edited work, Losing Trust in the World, Holocaust Scholars Confront Torture. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join us next time when I'll talk with Peter Hayes about his book, Why? Explaining the Holocaust. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.